Hello. On this week's program, we listen back to an interview with writer Steve Lopez. His story of destitute musician Nathaniel Ayers is now being made into a major Hollywood movie. Tom Keels explores how Laurel Hill Cemetery, a Philadelphia Victorian-era burial ground, is helping local area residents to grieve for those lost to war and urban violence. Susan Lewis looks at modern art in Japanese kimonos in an exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And Jason Pfeiffer visits the Efferta Cloister in Lancaster County, one of America's earliest religious communities. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In 2005, on a busy street corner in downtown L.A., former Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Steve Lopez heard a beautiful melody being drawn from a battered violin by a shabbily-dressed homeless man. Nathaniel Ayers had once been a promising musician, studying bass at Juilliard. Now destitute and suffering with mental illness, he was living on the streets. What started off as a series of columns for the LA Times turned into a mission for Lopez, and he has, over the past 3 years, formed a close friendship with Ayers that has taken the musician off the streets and into a more stable existence. Steve Lopez tells this story in a new book called The Soloist, and in a soon-to-be-released big-budget movie. Lopez talks about his experiences at the Central Branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia this afternoon. He spoke with us yesterday morning.
Downtown Los Angeles is a very busy place. It's thousands of people walking to and from work, and he did not appear to be playing for money. He didn't have the violin case open. He didn't have a hat out. He was just playing to play music. And I said, well, why do you pick this particular spot? And he pointed across the street, and he said, there's the Beethoven statue. I play here for inspiration. And so then I knew I might have something, but it took several visits to figure out what this guy's story was, and with each visit, he warmed up to me a little more, and I was able to tug the story out of him, and the big break comes when he's scratching names on the sidewalk, and I ask him, who's Betty and Albert and Tom and, Rebecca, and he said, those were my classmates at Juilliard. And I said, Nathaniel, you went to the Juilliard School for the Performing Arts? He said, oh, yeah, that was a while back. He said it quite nonchalantly, like it's no big deal to go to Juilliard. And I'm thinking, okay, we've got an African-American man, homeless, playing a violin, missing two strings, went to Juilliard. I think I've got a column.
Nathaniel, at this point, wouldn't have appeared to have been a very, shall we say, reliable source. How did you go about verifying this story?
Well, you know, I would ask Nathaniel on the street there, who can I talk to get the backstory on this? And how did you train in Cleveland? How did you become a musician? And he said, well, you know, I grew up it was kind of a tough neighborhood. His mother had a beauty salon. His dad was out of the picture. Mom had music on in the beauty salon. And Nathaniel just took to the music. He'd go there after school. The ladies are all having their hair done. And Nathaniel's enjoying the music. And his mother says, maybe you should take piano lessons. So he does a couple years of that and then goes to junior high band. And that's, you know, we're talking 60s when public schools in America had extensive arts programs. It was considered part of a well-rounded education, and everybody was handed an instrument, and the arts were big. It was before we got into the three R's and not much else. So he had a natural thing for it, and his junior high band teacher had him playing several instruments, but nobody could play the bass. And Nathaniel was a strong kid, and they needed a rhythm section. And Nathaniel was pushed in the corner with the bass and became so good on it in such a hurry that his teacher, Mr. Moon, said, I can't help you. You're going to have to go to see this guy in the Cleveland Symphony. His name is Harry Barnoff. He's been in the orchestra forever, and he teaches some of my better students. And that became his tutor. So I'm on the street in downtown L.A., and I said, Nathaniel, who influenced you? And he said, oh, you can call Mr. Harry Barnoff in Cleveland. And I said, well, how do I get hold of him? And with an index finger, thin air, writes out his phone number. And I scribble it in my notebook. And I said, are you still in contact with him? He said, nope, I haven't talked to him in decades. So I'm calling the number thinking it can't be any good. And somebody picks up on the other end and says, Barnoff residence.
Wow.
So Harry Barnoff told me that Harry was in tears when I told him that his former student was playing a a two-string violin in downtown Los Angeles living out of a shopping cart. And he said, that was one of the most promising students I ever had, and my heart is broken hearing this. He was such a great kid, and it was so tragic to see his crash.
People, we love a great story about redemption, and this really is just such a story, is it not?
This is, I think it's a story about second chances and human connections and the power of art and music. It has saved him. In his third year at Juilliard, he starts getting very confused and having trouble focus. And when you go through the transcripts, if he's having to sit in a classroom and study the history of music literature, his grades are falling. If he's in performance with the orchestra, he's getting A's. And the teacher comments are, promising young talent, renew his scholarship, unlimited potential. Nobody knew that he was losing his mind. And Juilliard at the time, as far as I can gather, was not a welcoming place. And there was nobody there to pick up on little emotional problems or psychological problems. And there was one teacher there, a bass teacher by the name of Gary Carr, who went on to be the rare person with a solo career as a bassist, who saw that Nathaniel was having problems. And he told the administration, they said, no, he's just a troublemaker. And he said, no, he is losing his mind, which indeed he was. So he crashes, goes home to Cleveland. He's in and out of his mother's house. He's on the streets. He realizes he can't lug a bass around in a shopping cart. He saves up money working at Wendy's and shoveling snow, walks 15 miles, buys a violin, and has been trying to teach himself other instruments all these years later. So I meet him, and he's down and out, but... You know, this serendipitous encounter leads to what has been a really deep and meaningful three-year odyssey and one of the most meaningful relationships and friendships in my life.
Los Angeles Times columnist Steve Lopez. The Soloist is published by Penguin. The movie of the same name based on Lopez's book, starring Jamie Foxx and Robert Downey Jr., will be released in November.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
In the Victorian era, rural cemeteries were called the last great necessity, the amenity that every city needed to house its dead, with the same dignity as the living. Boston had Mount Auburn, New York had Greenwood and Wood Lawn, and Philadelphia had its own resting place on the banks of the Schuylkill River. Now, Thomas Keels explores Laurel Hill Cemetery to discover how it honored Philadelphians of the 19th century and how it's now making itself relevant in the 21st century.
Memorial Day Sunday at Laurel Hill Cemetery. On a hot, sunny morning, Civil War soldiers in heavy wool uniforms march among the graves, accompanied by ladies in hoop skirts, their faces hidden by veils. Behind these Victorian apparitions is a troop of modern warriors, men and women in the white uniforms of the U.S. Navy. All have gathered to recreate the first Memorial Day in Philadelphia, as Temple University professor Andy Waskey explains.
Memorial Day was initiated by the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the veterans organization founded after the Civil War by the Union veterans. The very first Memorial Day service in Philadelphia was held right here at Laurel Hill on May the 30th, 1868. Therefore, it makes it the 140th anniversary of that service.
Founded in 1836, Laurel Hill was the first rural cemetery in Philadelphia. It was an alternative to the city's overcrowded and unkempt churchyards, an Arcadian landscape of beautiful trees and elaborate monuments. Laurel Hill and other rural cemeteries softened the harsh face of mortality in 19th century America, where parents could expect to see half their children die before the age of five. Michael Brooks, Laurel Hill tour guide and Westchester University professor, believes that rural cemeteries reflected Victorians' changing attitudes toward death.
They inherited from their parents a fairly grim view of death. They want to warn you that death is inevitable and you're probably going to hell. So the Victorians revolted against this on a large scale. They wanted to tell you that you're probably only sleeping temporarily. You're going to wake up. You're going to be in a better place. And in the meantime, you're in a better place because there are these beautiful lawns and trees and flowers and a nice stone overhead, and you're remembered.
Laurel Hill attracted the living as well as the dead. As many as 40,000 visitors a year during the Civil War, long before Philadelphia had its first public park, arboretum, or art gallery, Laurel Hill served in all three capacities. But Laurel Hill's golden age ended in the 20th century. Reduced mortality meant that Americans could distance themselves from death. Suddenly, the idea of a Sunday stroll through a graveyard seemed ghoulish. By the 1970s, Brooks recalls, the cemetery had fallen into a state of less than genteel neglect.
The grass wasn't as cut as often. A monument that was decaying and falling apart was kind of continuing to decay and fall apart. So before the intervention, before the Friends, before the campaign for historic preservation, it wasn't that it was a disaster, but it was a sort of slow downward slope. And at that point, the trustees said, we've got to do something.
In 1976, the preservation group, the Friends of Laurel Hill Cemetery, was created. Over the past 30 years, the Friends have restored hundreds of historic monuments and sponsored tours of the cemetery, including the popular annual Halloween tours. As Laurel Hill has grown more pristine, however, its surrounding neighborhoods have become more violent, spawning new variations on mourning rituals, like the wall mural memorial that Michael Brooks observed in North Philadelphia.
It's simply a representation of a young man with a bandana on his head, and he's, I would guess, in his early 20s, and he looks kind of athletic and a good kid. And as I was looking at this and taking a picture, I was stopped by a lady who said that that was her nephew. He had been shot, and his mother lived opposite. I spoke briefly to his mother. His mother scarcely spoke English. She spoke largely Spanish. But can you imagine coming out of your home every day, every time you come out of your home, and there is the, this large image of what you've lost.
The increase in gun violence in American cities, along with the rising toll in Iraq and Afghanistan, is making youthful death a more common experience. To aid young victims of violence in Philadelphia, the Friends of Laurel Hill Cemetery is launching the Urban Mourning Project. Gwen Kaminsky, Director of Development and Programming, believes that the project will help children deal with their own grief within a creative and historical context.
We're allowing the children to engage with art educators, grief counselors, therapists, and community leaders and supporters to explore their feelings of grief and loss resultant of urban violence. And they're going to be doing that through two primary vehicles, and that's education, specifically history, and art therapy.
The Urban Mourning Project will begin this September at the Church of the Advocate on Diamond Street in North Philadelphia. The pilot program will include 15 children, all of whom have lost a relative or friend to violence. Ross Mitchell, executive director of the Friends of Laurel Hill, believes that the cemetery's tradition of mourning rituals makes it ideally suited to sponsor the Urban Mourning Project.
There is a Victorian symbolic language of the dead that is written in the stones. A downturned torch symbolizes someone whose life was snuffed out, but the torch still burning symbolizes resurrection. A broken column symbolizes someone who has met an early death. A lamb symbolizes a child's death. A broken urn symbolizes somebody who has met a violent death.
Mitchell argues that these 19th century symbols have their counterparts in the mean streets of 21st century Philadelphia.
The broken urn is the teddy bear memorial of its day. And that seeing the memorials in the city, the spray-painted rest in peace murals, the rest in peace memorial tattoos and t-shirts, the rest in peace initials on the back of the car trunks. I mean, these are all urban mourning rituals in which we have over 170 years of history. So I think we're really well placed to make the connection between what went before, what is going on now, and giving Laurel Hill relevance and helping children in the community.
The Urban Mourning Project is only one of the ways in which Laurel Hill Cemetery is reinventing itself. Some of its other initiatives are much more lighthearted, in a macabre, whistling-in-the-graveyard kind of way. Just last month, Laurel Hill launched a guerrilla marketing campaign designed by the firm of Red Tetimer.
There are vinyl clings that go on the ground that mimic the background of the stone or whatever texture of ground it's on. And it says, here lies no one. What a waste of perfectly good granite, for example, with our logo and website. And we also have a fake anvil with a sticker that on the bottom that it's hanging from a frayed rope. And when you walk under it and you look up, it says there are better ways to get to Laurel Hill.
When Laurel Hill opened in 1836, its president wrote that he intended it to be a place where family affection could be gratified in the assurance that the remains of father and child, husband and wife, could repose side by side, undisturbed by the changing interests of man. For over a century, the natural beauty and serenity of Laurel Hill Cemetery allowed grieving Philadelphians to achieve the Victorian ideal of the good death. Today, Laurel Hill still serves as a peaceful oasis in the middle of an often brutal city, helping young Philadelphians to accept and transcend the violent deaths of their loved ones.
WRTI's Tom Keels. He's the author of Philadelphia Graveyards and Cemeteries and the recently released Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square, both published by Arcadia. Laurel Hill is open 7 days a week and admission is free. Today, most people in Japan wear Western-style clothing, which took root there in the mid-20th century. But for hundreds of years before, the traditional national dress was a sleek one-piece front wrap robe called a kimono, secured at the waist with a sash called an obi. An exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art demonstrates how, in its later days as daily attire, the Japanese kimono adapted its ancient form to modern sensibilities. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Fashioning Kimono, Art Deco and Modernism in Japan.
Beyond a doorway curtain, a visual field of color adorns the pale walls of the new windowless gallery. Fabrics in brilliant reds and turquoise, yellows, purples, oranges, pinks, and greens. Some are detailed and delicate. Landscapes painted on are woven into the surface. Some have floral patterns or other natural motifs. Still others boast large, bold, geometric shapes or wavy lines that seem almost to move. These works could be decorative wall hangings. They are, instead, kimonos, which means, literally, thing to wear.
These kimonos do look like art the way we have them here because they're flat and they're spread open and you can really see them, but it's important to remember they really were worn.
Christina Haugland, the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Associate Curator for Costumes and Textiles, says these kimonos, like all clothing, Western dress included, make a statement about values and identity.
These kimono that have all these updated modern designs from that period are really a way to be very modern, yet still be Japanese.
This exhibition of approximately 80 kimonos focuses on the period from the early to mid-20th century, when Japan began incorporating Western ideas, culture, and dress. They're part of the private holdings of Jeffrey Montgomery, an American living in Switzerland, who, while traveling to Japan collecting folk art such as ceramics and lacquer, happened upon some kimonos.
I would see these in shops and in marketplaces, and I would walk by them, and then I would be thinking about, oh, that design was, it just reminded me of Art Nouveau, Art Deco, and who in the Western world would even think of putting colors and designs together in that manner? And it works.
While all clothing may make some kind of statement, the kimono's rectangular design from a single swath of fabric with minimal cutting or tailoring gives its creator a large, flat surface on which to paint or design. Only when the kimono is worn and tied with its sash, or obi, does it take on the shape of a human figure. Either way, Felice Fisher, Philadelphia Museum of Art curator for Japanese and Asian art, says it's definitely art.
And some kimono are even painted by famous artists. So they're a moving canvas, if you like.
While these kimonos are hung for display, vintage photographs in this exhibition illustrate how the kimonos were worn. The first section of the gallery provides historical context, with kimonos that illustrate the traditional styling and patterns. Some are adorned with images of bamboo or plum blossoms, and birds, particularly cranes. Styles and techniques reflect the wearer's status, says Haugland.
The longer sleeves are worn by young women. These black kimono are worn by married women for the most formal occasions. So there's a whole sort of rank of the kimono, and this small section reflects that.
One brilliant red under kimono has a woven design of cranes and leaves integrated with a pointillistic pattern of white dots illustrating shibori, an elaborate tie-dyeing technique once forbidden to commoners. Shibori involves bunching up and binding, in this case, hundreds of tiny pinches of fabric, so when the whole cloth is dipped into the dye, the pinched fabric won't take the color. Under kimonos and linings could be used to hide something beautiful or forbidden, or perhaps just more flashy than the wearer would want the entire world to see. For example, many men's kimonos are, on the outside, dark and conservative. Think business suit. But on the inside,
their linings and their under kimono could be very, very elaborate, either elaborately patterned under kimono, or then the jacket linings could be hand-painted with scenes that really reflect the traditional Japanese brushwork and that kind of thing.
In the first half of the 20th century, technology produced new synthetic dyes and machine-made fabric. Onto these traditionally shaped garments were put distinctively modern images, like those on a kimono for a little boy, which caught the attention of Karen Caruza, an instructor at the Art Institute of Philadelphia.
And the print are these stylized cars from the 1920s. So right there, that is fast-tracking him from the little boy with maybe a traditional dark-colored kimono with a very faint print on it, and he's being fast-tracked now into the age of modernism, the machine age.
Modern images, both representational and abstract, were used in women's kimonos with bold colors and large instead of small designs. Some were wavy in the style of Art Nouveau, some more Art Deco, with angular shapes, big polka dots, even, in one kimono, images of the Empire State Building. These were part of a larger cross-cultural exchange of ideas, says curator Felice Fisher, that began in the 1800s.
I guess the most obvious example are the Japanese woodcut prints and Impressionist painters, and the Europeans getting it, then the Japanese coming to Europe, to Paris, to study painting in the 20s, and bringing back Art Nouveau and Art Deco to Japan.
The oldest kimono in this exhibition dates from around 1950. Today, women in Japan wear kimonos for special occasions, as Temple University student Takako Sato did for her coming-of-age party when she was 20. Sato regards the kimono as a highly personal connection with her own tradition.
Wherever I am, if I put it on, I will become a Japanese woman who don't have to envy any other race or ethnicity. I can be proud of being a Japanese woman.
Yet the kimono is also sparking interest as fashion. Art Institute of Philadelphia instructor Karen Caruza says her American students today are fascinated by this ritualistic garment.
What makes a geisha so beautiful and so erotic when she's all covered up? You know, it's the color that peeks out, that's coming through, the shift of the kimono, how far it shifts back and how much of the nape of the neck and the back shows, because that's the erogenous zone in that culture. So that's really similar to low-rise jeans here. The further the dip is, you know, the more erotic.
Cool clothing, beautiful art. The kimono fits well in history, on museum walls, and wrapped around the human figure as the newest, as well as one of the oldest, ways to express identity, tradition, and evolving culture.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Fashioning kimono, Art Deco, and modernism in Japan is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through July 20th. When the King of England gave William Penn the land we now know as Pennsylvania in 1681, the state's Quaker founder was intent on building a colony, a holy experiment, that would guarantee freedom of religion for its inhabitants. At a time when people were expected to adhere to the faith of their king, queen, prince, or duke, this religious tolerance attracted many oppressed and persecuted groups from Europe, such as Moravians, Mennonites, and Dunkards. The town of Ephrata in Lancaster County is a prime example of the refuge that Pennsylvania provided for many, and as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the National Historic Landmark that is the Ephrata Cloister tells the intriguing story of one of America's earliest religious communities, known also for its art, music, and printmaking.
Today, the Ephrata borough is home to about 13,000 people. But the town's origins can essentially be traced back to one person, Conrad Beisel, a native of Germany who emigrated to the Philadelphia region in 1720. Beisel's convictions drove him to pursue a hermit's lifestyle in the northern part of Lancaster County. When he moved to the Ephrata area in 1732, it was considered the wilderness, the edge of civilization. Beisel's plans for a solitary life didn't entirely pan out, however, as his charismatic leadership attracted followers. As more and more people came to join Beisel and a group coalesced, they began to institute communal living practices, forming what became known as the Ephrata Cloister.
start out straight ahead there in the kitchen.
Dressed in a white robe that resembles what the cloister members would have worn, Andrea Hefner is a tour guide at the Efferta Cloister. She says at the height of the community, between 1740 and 1750, there were about 300 members. The settlement was made up of two main groups. First, there were the brothers and sisters, a group of 80 celibate followers who wanted to live on the grounds with Beisel.
They wanted to dress a certain way, eat a certain way, live a very strict life of self-discipline in hopes that someday they would have the chance to be spiritually united with God in heaven.
Another significant part of the community was the books and artwork that the society produced. At its zenith, the cloister had the largest printing operation west of Philadelphia, a complete publishing center which included a paper mill, printing office, and book bindery. The cloister produced its own publications, but also printed for clients outside of Ephrata. Moan says many of the cloister's books and walls were decorated with some of the earliest North American works of Fruchterschriften, a Germanic calligraphy.
They had their own distinct style about it. They spent their time composing large wall charts with biblical sayings or sayings by Beisel. They decorated book plates and other books and used that form in different ways, you know, as a way of expression and of denial and regimentation and discipline, where the journey was more important than the end result.
The disciplined cloister lifestyle that called for celibacy, monastic garb, and learning the art of Fruchterschriften pervaded all other aspects of life for the brothers and sisters. For example, their sleeping patterns had strict guidelines. They would sleep on 15-inch wide benches with a small block of wood as a rather hard pillow. The brothers and sisters would only sleep about 6 hours a night for 3 hours at a time. They'd wake up in the middle of the night for a 2-hour prayer service. The workdays would start at 5 a.m., and including about 4 1-hour-long prayer sessions would last until about 6 p.m., dinner time. Incredibly, they only had one main meal a day. Then, after dinner, it was off to lessons. The cloister residents capped off their day with either communal writing lessons or singing lessons. Conrad Beisel loved music. He often led the singers himself, and he wrote many hymns. The cloister as a whole produced hundreds of songs. Susan Schober is the former president of the Ephrata Cloister Associates, a volunteer organization that helps preserve the historic landmark, and a member of the Ephrata Cloister Chorus. The choir was formed in 1959 to interpret and keep the music of the cloister alive.
I guess I like to know that I'm a part of keeping that tradition going.
Schober says Beisel wrote a treatise on how to harmonize music. So whoever wrote music on the cloister property had to follow his guidelines.
He had never been formally trained in music. So his guidelines had more to do with spiritual things. There were like master notes and servant notes and things like that. So it's not conventional music.
Schober says because they don't know exactly how this music originally sounded, it wasn't composed on paper by traditional methods, the choir is not out to recreate the original cloister music. They're more interested in helping to tell the cloister's story. Today, the cloister is a place to not only learn about the rich heritage of the unusual lives led by Conrad Beisel and his followers, it's also an opportunity to explore the groundbreaking legacy of Pennsylvania, a colony built on traditions of religious tolerance and freedom under the law.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Ephrata Cloister in Lancaster County is open to visitors year-round. And that's our program. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.